Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. In this week's episode, we have G. Arnell Williams here, and he's going to be talking about his book, Algebra the Beautiful, and the process behind taking on such a monumental task of writing about algebra, and how that differed from his first book. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Gerald Arnell Williams, but I write under the name G. Arnell Williams, and I've been at San Juan College for 27 years and teach mathematics from what's called the developmental area all the way up through the transfer level.
Thank you for coming in. So this is your second book.
Yes.
Your first book was more focused on arithmetic.
Right, yeah. It's How Math Works, A Guide to Grade School Arithmetic for Parents and Teachers. And that book was designed to try to show how ubiquitous numbers are and how we use numbers in ways that we don't think about, and also where it came from. The number system we use today as opposed to Roman numerals or Babylonian numerals, cuneiform numerals, and so on. And also where the algorithms that we generally are taught in school, where they come from.
I'm not great at math. Being able to understand where parts of math come from or why I'm doing it has always been extremely helpful to me when I am trying to get through math. And last math class I had to take was the business calculus class.
Oh, wow.
And I was dreading it so much because I cried through the last algebra class that I had taken. And I was really surprised because it was all conceptual. It was a lot of word problems, and it finally like really started clicking for me. And reading Algebra the Beautiful, so much of this stuff makes so much more sense now.
What is ideas behind it all? So
yes, and I was really engaged in reading this. So tell me how the process of writing your first book was different from writing this one.
Well, the first book I wrote actually many years after I'd been teaching, and I had collected a lot of ideas, and then I started thinking I had a book out of it. And then as I focused on that, you know, the ideas started to crystallize. I started thinking about them in folders and organizing them in terms of chapters for a book. But it evolved slowly because the idea of writing a book seemed insurmountable at that point. And how do I make it all fit? And then as I really got into the details of it, several years later, I realized I really had two books worth of material. And then I had to pare that down to try to make it so it was one book, and that basically became the focus. Instead of being arithmetic with fractions and integers and everything, I just was going to focus on whole numbers and numeration, where the numerals came from and the power of them. So it took a long period of time, and I had ideas where I wanted to go with it, and so I got that going, and then it really started to crystallize. The problem, though, was when I tried to find a publisher. Of course, I had several rejections, which is part of the process. You just have to have a tough skin and deal with that, and it's not always because they don't think it's publishing. It's just that it doesn't fit with their goal and their genres at that time. I did get a couple of good rejections, which said they were encouraging, that it just didn't fit their line. Finally, I got an editor that was interested, and that was with Roman and Littlefield. And we had a conversation, and she basically said she had some good news and some bad news. The good news was she was interested. The bad news was that if they were going to publish me, I was going to have to change the organization of my material. She said the material was good, but that it needed to be reorganized. So I didn't really have to drop anything out, just reorganize it. The idea being that I'm not writing to a class that she termed a captive audience, because they're there. They have the requirements, so you can take time developing your subject, and they're not going to leave. But with the book, you got to capture them quickly, or they're going to leave. And so she was saying that the way I had organized material wasn't doing that, and so suggested a rewrite. And I, of course, agreed. I mean, I had many rejections, and so I was pleased that someone was really interested in talking to me and developing to that level. And as I started writing it with her suggestions in mind, I realized it actually was making it better. And that was really rewarding. It was good feedback. We went several months back and forth where I present a chapter, revise, and so on. And then eventually they have a group, a board, that has to be convinced that the book's worth publishing. And at that point, she felt that the material was organized enough that we could present, and then that happened, and they were open to publishing it, and then the rest is history with that book. The second book, I wrote with that in mind. I learned mm-hmm. from that. And so the second book, it was easier because I had a better idea how to write a popular math book for the public mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So when I finally found another publisher, that was not the problem. And my search was less for the second book. But in terms of the details, when I finished the first book, I had lots of detail for the first book. So that was, I had a bunch of material for that one. And when I actually was finishing the first book, I wanted to do a book on algebra, but I would say the ideas, the juice for the flow of a book really hadn't occurred until probably a year, maybe a year and a half before I finished the first book. And then I started to get all these algebra ideas that I taught in class and things, but the ideas really started coming. And then I started recording things. And then I just delved into the book after. I took about 6 months after my first book was published before I really started the second book. And things just flowed. But I didn't have a bunch of backlog material. It's like it was sort of an evolving thing as I was going. And it was fun. It's exciting. It's exciting like when you explain, just teaching is exciting when you really love the ideas and you're trying to convey it because it gives you the chance to organize the material for people to understand. And that's fun if you can do that in ways that people resonate with. And so that's kind of how the second book went, and the ideas were evolving and just clicking. And it, when you have this synergy, these epiphanies and things going, and like, yeah, this is really clicking. It's really powerful.
To have such two different styles from the first book to the second book. Mm-hmm. It sounds like outlined, detail-oriented. You had a lot of ideas going with the first book, and then the second book being able to explore and develop as you're writing.
Right.
In fiction, we'd call it like plotter or pantser. Mm-hmm. And usually, you know, people are kind of one or the other, finding that like flow between how much you have to pre-plan and how much is just discovering it as you go. And then
it's rewarding too, because you mm-hmm. rewarding in a way that, I guess to use a music thing, you want to know if you're not just a one-hit wonder. Although one-hit wonder is still a wonderful thing. I always tell people when they look at a musician or something who's a one-hit wonder, kind of like that's a negative thing. And I'm like, well, most people are no-hit wonders. So mm-hmm. it's like one hit is fine if that's all you do. But it was nice to know that I still had energy and juice for second book, and that it was comparable or if not even better to the first book. So.
Yeah. I can see that creative process as you're going through in the way that you bring so many other elements outside of math into your explanations and your descriptions. And I love baseball, my favorite sport to watch. You had a section there where you talked about the slugging percentage.
Oh, right.
And what that is and how it's calculated. I was like, oh, that makes so much more sense now.
Well, thanks. Oh, that's great. You're here because, I mean, not everybody's a baseball fan, but it's just lended itself to that because it's really comparable mm-hmm. to GPA, of course, but there's that parallel that you can tie and then to the rest of that chapter.
Just found a lot of moments through that where I was able to make that connection of something that I think just makes such a huge difference. And it was really neat to read that.
Well, thanks for sharing that, because that's one of the things I often tell my students. A lot of the readers looking at math, not from the first time, but looking at it a second time or maybe a third time, and maybe didn't have that good first experience. But I always tell students those are advantages, actually. You're coming back at it from a mature vantage point. You may not think you've been doing much, but you've been learning. You've been experiencing things. And actually looking back at the math in a different way, in a more global perspective, actually gives you some advantages that maybe younger students don't have who may be good at it. But that global perspective from an adult, maturist perspective actually is a strong thing as well. And that, mm-hmm. that not to sell themselves short. That's one of the things I had in mind with the book, because I saw that in my classes, so I wanted to share that with a larger audience, and particularly algebra, because it's such a maligned subject, and much more than arithmetic, because even if people don't like arithmetic, they usually don't question its value. Algebra is where people really start to question its value. And so that was my task, is to really make people rethink what algebra is about and see how it connects to other systems. And because they're older, they have life experience. You know a lot more, and so that allows me to bring in more than perhaps sometimes in the younger classes.
Well, and you brought up the idea of experience.
That was Dewey's argument?
The small experiences uh-huh, uh-huh. and then them all coming together uh-huh. and how that really can apply to math and particularly to algebra. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that.
Well, that probably goes back to when I was a student taking math and science classes. I was a physics major as an undergrad, and most of those classes had comprehensive finals, which brought mm-hmm. everything together. And I know a lot of students don't like that, but I loved it. Because that would allow me, I'd often go up to an empty room on campus and just use the blackboard or the whiteboard, depending, and try to tell the story of the course. And most times, almost every time, I could tell a coherent story. By doing that, it really helped me understand, enlarge my understanding of the course. So I kind of had an experience. What Dewey's describing as those experiences is not just, you know, having something happen to you. It's a consummation. It's like, okay, everything fits. Now I can tell the story of that course. And then where there are sometimes holes, I can fill those in, and it just enlarges the understanding. So that experience, that epiphany, if you will, is something that I had. And then that more of them came as I started reading more about math on my own, as I started to read from people such as Lancelot Hogben, who wrote a book called Mathematics for the Million in the 1930s. Or Tobias Danzig's book on number, the language of science, as well as more modern books as well that gave me conceptual viewpoints and brought even more things together, and really was a powerful, it changed my life really in that sense, because I decided that I really wanted to explore math and share that with others. And so that statement that I put in the introduction is something I want to share with others. I kind of had to go exploring for it in some ways, and some teachers gave me that, but some teachers did not. And my goal was to try to give that to students so that, of course, students still have to pick things and take it and run with it. But the more I could help them see the big picture, the better. And that's the goal of my teaching. And that's always been the goal from day one, as well as the book, which is an extension of that. Although they're different platforms. So writing, you have to do it in a different way than teaching, where you have them captive.
I think any form of writing, considering that audience and how to best reach them and what approach to take to get your information to your audience. When I was working for a newspaper, that was a very different approach writing journalistic articles than what I typically approach with fiction. And so I imagine, moving from a teaching setting where you have your students right there to someone out in the public who might pick up your book, and how to convey those messages in the written form rather than being able to be there and expound in person and be like, oh, I don't quite get this. Here's some more details.
All right. Well, there are parallels between actually speech and writing itself as communication forms, and they both have advantages. And I mean, writing has some great advantages that speech doesn't. And the same is true with writing a book. There's things I could explore in probably more depth with the book, and I could kind of define where I wanted to go. Whereas in a classroom setting, you do have a curriculum you have to get through, different materials covered. So that does confine some. I still get in what I need to do, you know, in terms of the conceptual and that sort of thing. But in the book, you can explore it in deeper ways because, you know, it's your book. You can control that to a certain degree. And I also like writing for the general public, like a trade book, as opposed to a textbook, because a textbook isn't completely your book. And when you write a textbook, you have to sell it. You're selling it to people who actually aren't the consumers of the book. You're selling it to teachers. But the actual students are the ones that use the book. And so that can be conflicting, because teachers' goals and the goals in the class a student sometimes need aren't the same. And so that's why I enjoy trade books. I'm not knocking textbooks. Textbooks are obviously very important, and I admire the textbook writers, especially the good ones who do that. But they are navigating different waters than an author writing a trade book.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I remember studying New Mexico history in high school, and then when my kids were taking New Mexico history, and they both complained to no end about how boring it was. And when I took a New Mexico history class in college, I was like, this is so fascinating. I probably learned a lot of that, but I obviously didn't retain it from high school.
It was probably done differently, though, too, in college as opposed to in high school, yeah.
Well, it was so much more, the textbook that they chose was really done in a style of, like, storytelling. Here's this period, we're going to tell you the overall events that happened. And for me, being, you know, very story-oriented, I really connected with that, and I enjoyed learning about history at that point. And I imagine doing that for math was even more complicated than history, where it's probably a little bit harder to put that in story form, but I think you did a really good job with that.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's some of that, again, I probably develop in the story and learning to view math in that way, particularly when you do a lot of it on your own, it's probably harder, even as a student, than history, because history, I think, lends itself more to storytelling, although you can do it as dates and things, which does take out the story. But I still think it's probably a little bit more congenial to that than math. But there's a lot in math, too, and it's just getting into the framework. As I started teaching things and getting more into the narrative framework, I saw more opportunities. And a lot of times in one class, I get an idea for another class, and so I record those ideas. And I'm amazed at, I guess, how active your mind is when you're teaching things, because the ideas just come to me when I'm teaching the class that are, I don't know if I could think about them, if I wasn't doing that, if I didn't have that interaction with the students. It's just a wonderful synergy. So I enjoy the teaching aspects of it. And as I started to do more of a narrative viewpoint, I saw more opportunities, places to expand that narrative viewpoint. So you change your viewpoint, you actually start to look more, you can see more opportunities. It's almost like you put on different glasses and you see a different spectrum.
Well, and you mentioned the three different approaches that you took with the humanistic, the aesthetic, and conceptual, and how each of those can bring different elements into learning about and understanding mathematics. And so I wanted to ask you about that and, you know, if you actively thought about each of those approaches and how to use them as you were writing, or if they just kind of came together through your style of writing.
Well, mostly, I mean, from day one, from teaching, I mean, all of that was kind of, those things were there. Of course, they became sharpened and I improved upon them as I started teaching more and more. But they were all there, but they've kind of always been in my teaching. But I, one of the nice things about all of this, and particularly with the internet, is that there's so many books from the past that, because they've digitized them, that are available. I mean, most of these things would be in some library somewhere, which if you go to that library, you might see it. But otherwise, a lot of times they would be in rare books, so you'd have to make requests. A lot of these things now that, you know, are way past the copyright are actually available. And it's a beautiful thing in one way, but it's also humbling. Because sometimes you come up with these ideas that you say, hey, this is kind of a cool idea. And then you read a book 150 years ago and realize, oh, somebody else had that idea 150 years ago. that's rewarding in a way because, hey, I mean, I'm not off base here. And it also connects because I often say writing this book engaged me with kindred spirits, many of whom are not alive anymore. But they still were kindred spirits. They wrote books and they those sorts of things. And so a lot of that language, you know, the aesthetic and those things, people had put in their writing. You know, Dewey did some things. Alfred North Whitehead wrote beautiful ideas about education in his book, Aims of Education, I think it was 1929 when it first came out, that really gave me language to describe what I was trying to do. The humanistic viewpoint, another mathematician, Cassius Kaiser Jackson, and then William Thurston, who recently passed away in 2012, I believe. So some contemporaries. But all of that, you know, it allowed me to kind of put all of that, coalesce all that together and gave me more powerful language to describe what I was trying to do and sharpen what I was trying to do. And actually sometimes gave me new ideas and extended on that. So I would say I generally have written with the way I just try to explain things. It's sort of natural to me, but those things kind of encapsulate what I'm trying to do. And sometimes I do actively, I think, try to do some of that as well. But it's usually I just try to flow with the ideas. So I would say it's the material and my interaction with it that is the driving force, but I do use those as perspective. And then most of those things are describing what I'm doing in a way.
That's really neat. And I think someone who has such extensive knowledge of a subject that you can do that. And as you grow in your craft or in your subject, whatever it is, then you can more easily, I think, look at it from different perspectives and not just say, this is the way you look at it and this is the way you're going to understand it, or too bad.
No, right. I hear you. I think because of the way I kind of discovered math and became interested in it, was bringing those perspectives together. That's what got me interested in it. That's kind of always informed my teaching to a certain degree from day one. But obviously it's improved. I respond to certain types of problems. I, you know, have ideas I try. Sometimes students resonate well with it, and then sometimes it doesn't work. And that, you have to listen to what they're telling you.
And you talk about a concept of numbers as ensemble and how the appearance can be a little overwhelming at first when you're looking at algebra. There's all these numbers and letters and exponents and big things. And I think that's very true that people get overwhelmed looking at a page of algebra and being like, what do I do with this? But that idea of them as an ensemble, that you're taking out some of the scariness of that interpretation and looking at what they're doing.
Again, you're looking for metaphors to describe what variation is and what you're kind of doing. One of the ideas I used was maneuver, because in algebra, you're learning how to, you're calculating, you're computing, you're compressing things. But what are you really doing? Well, in some ways, it's maneuvering. You're maneuvering just like we maneuver to get out of the way of things and those sort of things. And people can see the maneuvers in other areas and trying to tie that with algebra and say that's actually what you're doing when you do algebraic computations or simplifications, you're maneuvering to gain insight. I think that metaphor really kind of ties. And the same thing with the variation, looking at all the variation of the numbers, which I call the symphony, right? And trying to tie it together with a musical symphony where you have all this variation in sound. but it's tied together oftentimes by a coherent theme. Some of the music composers with different symphonies are trying to convey certain themes, but they're using all this different variation. And in math, you've got all these, sometimes for different phenomena, you have these different representations of that phenomena, but an algebraic equation or algebraic expression can tie together that, tie all those things together in a powerful way. So trying to establish that, particularly with someone as dramatic and exciting as a composer as Beethoven was. And he wrote about what he was trying to do with his music and the electricity and that sort of thing. There really is a lot of electricity in the mathematical expressions when you think about it in certain ways, too.
Yeah, definitely. And that idea of understanding what the purpose of, whether it was a specific part of algebra or, you know, when I was in school, like the quadratic equation, like I'm still not sure I totally understand what the purpose of that is. And I would just beat my head against the wall trying to get through it and being able to really take away that, like, oh, this looks like something I'm not going to be able to do or understand, and then figure out, oh, this is what you're trying to accomplish. This is the purpose behind it. These are the, you know, the steps that you're going to take to accomplish a specific outcome. I think really just makes a big difference in what you're trying to teach to someone, whether it's just to plug in numbers and do this thing, and then here's an answer, or understand why you're doing it and what the value in the end goal is.
Well, one of the things with algebra, I think that doesn't get enough attention in writing, which is probably the truest revolution. I mean, there was the revolution in the 1500s in terms of solving equations, higher order equations. But there was another revolution, which, of course, mathematicians often know about, but I don't think it gets enough coverage in basic math classes or algebra classes, which is the introduction of the parameters, which was done in the late 1500s by a French mathematician, Francois Favet, whose idea of this really is the one that took hold, and then it was expanded upon in the 1600s by another French mathematician, René Descartes. So I try to bring that out, and that, funny you mentioned the quadratic formula, because that's one of the, even though my book doesn't go much into second order equations, it deals mostly with first order equations or linear equations, but thinking about them in different ways. The opportunity was there when I was introducing parameters in chapter 4 in terms of a business problem to talk about the quadratic formula and how those parameters, those different variables, and parameters are variables that are, they kind of have aspects of a variable but aspects of a constant. In a particular scenario, they can be constant, but then they can change value from scenario to scenario. And that's the idea that really blew the door off algebra and really made algebra into the modern discipline it is. And like I said, most times in elementary mathematics, that's not made clear. And so I try to make that clear, and quadratic formula offers an opportunity to do that in a way to maybe rethink it. I don't know if that helped with you in that particular, because I did talk about that, and then there was an appendix mm-hmm. where I do mention that just to kind of tie it together a little bit. But I don't go into much detail in the quadratic formula because I'm not dealing with second order equations, which might be in another book.
Well, and I was going to ask you if you have more books that you're thinking about, different focuses.
I definitely have some more ideas. I mean, first of all, there's more talk about in algebra. There's more talk about arithmetic. But then there's other areas. I mean, there's graphing, there's calculus, and even higher levels that I think, you know, from the perspective I'm doing this book, could be useful in helping people to better understand the subject. The nice thing about doing algebra is that algebra, most people have experienced it. So the math itself mm-hmm. is not new or strange, like sometimes the higher math that other writers nobly try to explain, and I applaud their efforts. But people aren't used to that math. With algebra, you have that, but I'm looking at algebra, the math that people know, from a more advanced viewpoint in terms of this unity, this coherence, this beauty of ideas that can hopefully give them new insights into a subject, sometimes hopefully key insights that can really sense the subject for them in a way they just didn't have before, completely change their attitude towards the subject or their viewpoint of the subject. That's my goal. So with higher level math, I mean, other subjects, I think that viewpoint can be useful as well. So I haven't decided exactly what I wanted to explore for the next book yet, but I have some ideas.
Well, that's really exciting because, yeah, I haven't talked to too many authors who write about math. Most of who I interview are fiction writers and that publishing process. Mm-hmm. And publishing in general, the process is similar.
Mm-hmm. I think with fiction, you have to almost have the book done, right? Is that right?
Yeah, typically, yeah.
Yeah. And nonfiction, I think when I found publisher both, like, I almost had them both done. But you can actually have 4 or 5 good chapters and interest someone, and they know that they know that that's what they want, and they can work with you from there too. So yeah. I found creative writing, although I do creative writing in this book as well, so it's not all, but I did take a course in creative writing when I was in college. That was it gave me a whole different respect for novelists and such, because it's hard. It's like, I found it challenging, I found it rewarding, I think it helped my writing overall, mm-hmm. But it was definitely different than just technical writing, where you kind of know where you want to go. But there's still creative writing in there, I think, to make the mm-hmm. book accessible to people and not just a pedantic book. You have to inject some of your creativity and the narrative into the book as well.
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed the narrative aspect of it, and that it wasn't just cut and dry, you know, textbook style. Mm-hmm. Especially for me personally, that's mm-hmm. always been a little bit harder for me to engage with.
I understand.
I do. I hope a lot of people pick this up and engage with it and get a better understanding, especially as a parent. It's so hard to go back to something that you haven't looked at or touched in 15 or more years and then try to help your kids with it.
Right. That's one of my goals, again, is to give people that insight. Because, I mean, adults, people who've been away from it are starting with an advantage in a way they don't realize they have an advantage. And my goal in doing this book is to try to get people to realize you actually have an advantage. Don't be afraid of this. Actually go back into it. Look at it in your more mature way, and you're more, in some ways, adults are trying to create more complicated tapestries, but that actually, so they're trying to create that narrative. And when they create that narrative and try to fill in those holes, I try to supply some of the things to help them fill in those holes so that they can complete that puzzle, at least to a certain degree, and hopefully want to learn more. In this book, in my books, I try to give people hopefully some insight. So even if they read those other books, they can look at, now they're looking at the algebra in a different way, they can see kind of the bigger goals that the other writers are getting at as well. Although I'd also like to hopefully see more of the good popular writers out there who write good popular math books focus on some of the basic areas too, because they can reach more audience that too. And I think that, you know, in terms of focusing the whole book on algebra, arithmetic, or that sort of thing, hasn't been done to the degree it needs to be. A lot of books touch on a chapter or two, but the material's interesting and sophisticated enough, even though we're familiar with it, but it's sophisticated enough that you can write whole books on it. I mean, this book is basically on a certain portion of Algebra 1, but there's a lot of stuff in there. There's a lot of ideas that these things compress. They just happened a while ago, so we take them for granted. I mean, particularly people who are good at math. But the idea is to look back at some of those things and use them as vehicles to illuminate the history as well as the beauty of math.
Definitely. And that kind of answers my last question of what you hope people take away from reading your book.
A better attitude towards math, and not afraid of it, appreciative of it, you know, of it, and recognizing the beauty of it, and understanding that it is a big deal, and that there are reasons why people want some of these classes to be required. Education is a very emotional, oftentimes confrontational subject, and my book pretty much makes an argument for, I mean, some folks want algebra gone from the curriculum period, pretty much all of it. Some want the first level algebra, you need some of that. But then when you get up into algebra 2 or higher level math, that maybe more diversification can happen. My book makes an argument that we need some algebra. We have to have some algebra that has to be in the curriculum. My book is an argument why that's needed and what people will miss. They don't have that. Just like people, we don't have to have computers, but if we know how to use computers, it enhances things. We can do things. We can find knowledge easier. We can learn new things and become better problem solvers in some cases, because we have access to more research. It opens up this larger world of possibilities. And algebra, elementary algebra, does that too. And maybe you don't have to have it to survive, absolutely survive or not. It can enhance things. It makes you, you know, makes you more marketable. It makes you a better to connect things and unify things and that sort of thing. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book. But I do think that math and quantitative reasoning is very important and doesn't need to go away. Trying to hit those arguments, hit those reasons head on, and not back down, and not just always coming up with the same patent arguments, but showing new ways of looking at this that show that these things are still relevant in the 21st century.
And I think your book does a really good job of making those arguments.
I hope this is at least for some of the readers.
And so if anyone is interested to check it out, it's Algebra the Beautiful, An Ode to Math's Least Loved Subject. And it's under the name G. Arnell Williams. And you can find it on Amazon and most other places that I looked at was available
Barnes
as well.
Noble, yeah.
Right
and,
out there.
Yeah, Target, yeah. All those. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. It's really great talking to you.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.